This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Since 1969, Rolling Stone magazine has brought you the finest in award-winning articles and pop culture news. Brilliantly covering diverse hot-button topics, all while reporting the finest in fashion, food, humor, and technology. But it's still Rolling Stone's long-respected history of covering the music and entertainment industry that keeps them as one of the world's most read magazines. It's Rolling Stone Magazine, coming up next on the Audio Reading Service.
Welcome. This is Rolling Stone. And I'm your reader, Christine, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the November issue of Rolling Stone, and I'll resume reading an article I began in last week's program titled, Untangling the Mystery of the Ark God. For a decade, one writer has tried to unravel the story of Dorje Chang, whose artwork sold for millions, and who claimed to be the third coming of Buddha. Then, out of nowhere, he got an email. Dorje Chang and his wife were dead. What really happened? By Joseph Bien Khan. And again, I'll resume reading where I left off. For reference, IAMA refers to the International Art Museum of America in San Francisco. This year, I spoke with four former employees at the IAMA who all shared similar stories. They'd studied art and then moved to San Francisco desperate for a job. Quickly, the strangeness of their new roles in the white column buildings on Market Street began to present itself. Maggie Prisant, hired to do marketing, felt stifled right away. She'd float ideas for Instagram posts or partnerships with other museums, and they'd go nowhere. I was very confused because it didn't seem like they wanted to actually market the museum, she remembers. To kill time, she'd wander the collection, trying to familiarize herself with the paintings. The works themselves are protected really aggressively under really thick glass, and the works themselves don't look very real, she says. I wasn't there very long, but I do know that part of the lore of this person was that some of his paintings were immaculately conceived. Like, he didn't actually create them with his physical. He created them with his mental. The other former staffers, who asked not to be identified because they continue working in the art world, also investigated their workplace. Each independently told me that at some point they realized Loretta Huang, who flew in from Los Angeles at the start of every week, slept in an upstairs apartment at the museum. To the staff, she never acknowledged living there, always arriving first and leaving last. When asked about her lodgings, Huang responded via email, "Curious and interesting, Joey BK! A person's private life will not be revealed." None of the staffers made enough to live comfortably in the city without a second job, just $17 an hour. Even that pay boggled their minds, though, because they couldn't understand how the museum managed to keep its doors open. One former staffer, who I'll call Sarah, handled the museum's QuickBooks and tells me she'd input donations, most of which came from abroad, but those were all between $5 and $1,000. Prisant explains that much of the focus seemed to be on the gift shop, which was on the street level, but even that barely brought in any funds. Another former staffer, who I'll call Eileen, was tasked with paying the museum's rent. She still remembers the amount because it was less than she was paying for her own small apartment, $1,200 a month. The museum's tax form 990 from 2021 begins to explain the way below market rate. Matthew Kwan, the IAMA's director and president, is listed as the manager of the LLC that owns the building. And it says the lease states, "This annual rent is substantially below the market rental. Lessor has forgone receiving part of the rental for the premises that lessor is entitled to receive because lessor wants to make a contribution to society." Though the admission was free, the cost to enter the treasure room was $600 per group of 10. Sarah remembers days when busloads of followers would arrive and Huang would tour them through the treasure room. To enter the room, Huang, Sarah, and the security guard arrived with separate keys to undo the locks. Sarah and the security guard were not invited in, but they listened through the large wooden doors as each group prayed by the art. Finally, after months, Huang invited Sarah and another employee in to view the crown jewel of the treasure room, Dorji Chang's sculpture. She was very serious. "This is what this guy can do. He can take rocks from the moon and bring them and put smoke in it and seal it in a glass box," Sarah says. Mia and the other guy looking were like, "I'm pretty sure this is melted PVC piping. This isn't stone. This is just a bunch of crap that's melted and spray painted." Sarah and her coworker became obsessed with understanding more about the art. She saw a large high-end printer in an office upstairs she theorizes was used to make prints of some of the supposedly original paintings that hung in the museum. She looked closely at the collection, believing she could see the printer lines, though she couldn't be sure because of the heavy glass. Then, one day, the glass that covered a painting broke, and when the workers were on break, she and her co-worker ran upstairs and touched the exposed work. And we were like, "Yeah, this is printer paper," she says. When I ask museum director Loretta Huang, she strongly disputes the facts of that story and writes, "HHDJB3 told me that all of the artwork pieces at the museum on display were original, created by himself." Despite the snooping, none of the former employees ever managed to answer the central question. To what end? I just assumed that they were a front for the cult, but they weren't trying to get people to join the cult, so that's why I was okay with being there, Eileen says. Because if they were like, "We need you to start recruiting people," then I'd be like, "No, I'm out of here." But Loretta was like, "We're here to show people free art," Eileen continues. And I really think that Loretta believes that. In February 2022, I received an email from a stranger with the subject line, "Dorje Chang Buddha." The body read only, "He passed away recently in Pasadena." It took a week to prove that information half right. The emailer has not responded to my repeated follow-ups. Despite the dozens of blogs and hundreds of online accounts that post tirelessly about their leader, the Dorje Chang-centric internet stayed remarkably silent in the days that followed. I found an obituary for Dorji Chang Buddha III on the website of Las Vegas Palms Eastern Mortuary and Cemetery. It said he died on January 27, 2022, at the age of 58. Soon, it was deleted. 2 weeks later, the Office of His Holiness Dorji Chang Buddha III released an official statement explaining that Dorji Chang and his wife, Yuhua Wang, also in her 50s, died together at a Las Vegas residence. The post recounts their last moments and last words. His wife is referred to as the Fomu, Holy Mother, the Great Mahasattva, in a nearly 5,000-word account. It explains that over the past few decades, the Buddha had often borne dark karma for living beings, appearing gravely ill for several months before making remarkable recoveries. This time, though, was different. The final paragraph begins, "Now, for the sake of saving our lives and our happiness, Namo Dorji Chang Buddha III and Fomu, Holy Mother, the Great Mahasattva, have sacrificed themselves and went to the Sambo Ga Kaya Buddha land. And what of those followers left behind? We most truly repent our sins and beseech Namo Dorji Chang Buddha III and Fomo to return to this world." I called and emailed coroners, police stations, and other government agencies around Los Angeles and Las Vegas, and none had heard anything about the deaths. Eventually, I found a death record for Dorji Chang, but nothing for his wife. As I searched for any information about the strange, simultaneous deaths of two supposedly world-famous artists and religious leaders, I began to wonder, could Wang still be alive? The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department wrote, "We are unable to locate any events listing the subjects or addresses you provided." The Clark County Coroner's representative said they couldn't find any records, but if they were in the hospital under the care of a doctor and died of natural causes, their deaths would not need to be reported to us. They recommended I contact the Southern Nevada Health District, where a representative said they couldn't provide any details aside from confirmation that there was a death record from Yuhua Shouzi Wan. Last October, the L.A. County Assessor told me of the family's Pasadena home. Per our records, the owner is his spouse, Wang Yuhua Shouzi. If she is also now deceased, we have not received any notification. When I followed up in April, they wrote, "We received a letter from the DEKA Law Group in January 2023 that indicated that Yuhua Shouzi Wang is deceased. There was also a change of ownership statement, death, of real property owner received for her, plus a claim for reassessment exclusion for transfer between parent and child filed by Pui Chu Yi and Hang Kung Yi, claiming to be daughter and son. It says that her date of death was 2/5/2022. However, there is no copy of her death certificate. We only have the death certificate for Dorji Chang Buddha III. In August, 2.5 years after the deaths, the issue remained unresolved. Now, the email response stretched to 3 paragraphs, and the tone had changed. If Yuhua Shouzi Wang reportedly died on 2/5/2022, 8 months 8 months prior to the 10/18/2022 recording of her husband's affidavit of death, why didn't they also record an affidavit death for her, including a copy of her death certificate? Especially if she died outside of California. This was written by the assessor. Where is the documentation showing that Pui Chu Yi and Huang Kung Yi, claiming to be her daughter and son, are the beneficiaries? It seemed they too had found themselves stuck within the strange mist surrounding Dorji Chang. Soon after the deaths, I reached back out to the leaders of the many associated nonprofits and LLCs, and to followers of Dorji Chang, but almost everyone declined to be interviewed. Those who did respond shared no firsthand knowledge of the deaths, instead pointing me to the official release from the office of His Holiness Dorji Chang Buddha III. Jacques C. Juma emailed that she learned about the death in early February and was shocked. I saw him just before Christmas and he was very healthy, she wrote. In fact, he was never sick or ill himself, and on December 23, 2021, I saw him lift a pestle weighing almost 437.2 pounds for more than 13 seconds, with a hook using only four fingers of one hand, something that no any other person in our world could do. On a February 2022 call, Guavri explained he hadn't heard anything official about plans going forward, but that, for me, it doesn't change anything other than the fact that I won't have direct access to the Buddha Master. Loretta Huang shared that disciples had traveled from around the world to recite sutras at the Holy Miracle Temple in Pasadena three times a day and to chant continuously for 24 hours. By then, after so many years staring at a sideways world, everything had started to appear off kilter. I found myself wondering what, if any, of this was true. I'd heard devotional stories from followers and seen videos showing large groups praying to their Buddha Master. But then I'd reach out to experts who had never heard Dorji Chang's name. The auction prizes and the professorships and even the art hanging on the wall by now seemed illusory. Yet those claims, supernatural and all too terrestrial, still kept appearing atop search results like digital mantras. So it felt important to drive east to the Holy Miracle Temple. A living Buddha had given his life for his followers. The grief, at least, must be real. The temple's entrance sits between two buildings behind a wooden gate. I walked up, but it was locked, so I pressed my ear against the wood. And there it was, a rhythmic chant. I was surprised by my feelings when I heard it. The low hum was strangely grounding. In the shadow world I'd fallen into, it was hard to trust anything I saw or read, but I knew I heard the sound. On an overcast day this April, I again drive east to the Holy Miracle Temple. I'm met at the gate by a monk in a rust-colored robe, who greets me warmly but tells me she can't speak to me about Dorji Chang, even 2 years after his death. We're still in a period where our Buddha Master is entering Nirvana, so we're not doing any interviews, she says politely. I set off for Monterey Park and park across from a two-story home. The home is the listed address for the publisher of the book claiming Dorje Chang's divine origins. It's also the headquarters of the Office of His Holiness Dorje Chang Buddha III, the organization so many followers pointed me to for official answers throughout the years. I ring the bell, and no one answers. So I write a note introducing myself, slide it through the mail slot, and drive away. Finally, I head to the Dorje Chang family home. The hedges around the house are high, and a black gate blocks the entrance from the quiet, tree-shrouded road. I buzz and wait. Finally, a man in his 30s, with head shaved, walks toward me. I peek over the gate, introducing myself and telling him that I'm a journalist writing about Dorje Chang. He waves his hand, repeating, "I don't know, I don't know." Then he walks away. When I'd asked Guavri who might take over for Dorje Chang during that 2022 call, he'd told me he hadn't given it any thought. "Maybe no one," he'd said. "We were somewhat unique in that regard, in the sense that we were following the Buddha. Anything short of that is not that." 2 years after the deaths, it's still unclear from the outside who will ultimately steer the ship. But the ship continues to sail. I email Loretta Huang to ask for contact information for Dorje Chang's children. "It is very hard to get to see them. Regrets, I have no channel to recommend to you," she writes. I later sent certified letters to the family home, the Dika Law Group, and the Office of His Holiness Dorje Chang Buddha III. All were successfully delivered, but nobody responded to my queries. There was nobody to sign for my letter sent to Pui Chu Yi's home in Las Vegas. Huang shares an update. "A new temple has just opened in Las Vegas, and followers are working to build the Holy Heavenly Lake in Hesperia, California. After HHDCB3's passing, my Buddhist acquaintances and I continue to study the Dharma teachings," she writes. "Temples continue to flourish with devotees." I find a Las Vegas Review Journal story about the vibrant grand opening of the Benevolence Temple, where elected officials or their representatives entered and lined up in front of the main shrine, each holding a red ribbon shaped like a flower. Lieutenant Governor Stavros Anthony is quoted as saying, "Great day for the state of Nevada." Then I check my notes on the Holy Heavenly Lake. The plan is to turn the 120-acre site, purchased for $2.2 million, into the Buddhist Vatican, the spiritual center for all Buddhists around the world. I look at the tax filings and recognize the names of the LLC's two members, Hong Kong Yi and Pui Chu Yi, the son and daughter of His Holiness Dorje Chang Buddha III. I'll turn now to interviews with musicians on musicians, beginning with Renee Rapp and Cynthia Erivo. Places, Please. Both artists got their start acting on stage, and both know what it's like to fight for the career you really want. It's all love when these two stars meet up in New York. By Brittany Spanos. Within minutes of sitting down with each other at Electric Lady Studios in Manhattan's Greenwich Village, Renee Rapp and Cynthia Erivo realize that they're both Capricorns. They gush over how cosmic this meeting is after years of mutual admiration from afar. Now it all makes sense, Arrivo says. A Capricorn is someone who knows their own self and what they want, what they will stand for and what they will not. It's always really fun and refreshing to see. Rapp agrees. You're verbatim exactly the same way, like 100%. Once they get going, it's hard to get the two stars of stage, screen, and stereo to stop. They immediately connect on their clear-eyed visions of making their dreams come true from the jump. Along the way, they open up to each other about writing their next albums and Arrivo's upcoming role as Elphaba in the film adaptation of Wicked. Rapp is a big fan. The interview begins with Rapp. I first saw you when I was 16. The second Broadway show I ever saw was The Color Purple. You started performing, and I was like, okay, she's just different, on another planet, on another level. I immediately was so enamored with you because your presence is equally as amazing as your voice. I was like, oh, people are really singing here, and I was obsessed. Arrivo? That's so insane. I can't believe that was your second show to have ever seen. How soon after that did you experience Broadway? Rapp? 2 or 3 years later. Arrivo? What was that like for you? Rapp? I really wanted to do music, and I was working in and out of New York when I was in high school because I was recording, and I had switched to this performing arts high school because my parents really wanted me to go to college. I was like, not for me. And they were like, the F are you gonna do? You don't do well in school. You're not really picking up anything on the side. It's not going well for you. I was like, harsh, but correct. Arrivo, it's also early. There's so much time for all that to happen. You were literally discovering yourself. Rep, bro, super early. I innately knew I didn't want to go to school. So I switched to this performing arts high school and basically followed, or at least attempted to follow, what Hatestown star Ava Noblezada had done. Arrivo, it's interesting because when you were on Broadway, I think there was a change happening about what was on and how you could do it. The style was changing, and it was becoming far more varied, which is great. Rapp, well, I had watched you do it. It was just different. I would listen to your stuff in the car, and I was like, she's doing it. And it's just who you are and how you show up. It's not like you're doing something to be different. It's your voice. It's your tone. It's your presence. It was intoxicating. Arrivo, you said you always knew that you were going to do music. Crazy way to prove to your parents that you could get a job. Rep, definitely insane. Arrivo, did Broadway help give liftoff into who we know now? Rep, 100%. I had auditioned for Mean Girls and my agents were like, you're just too young. That was the thing I wanted to be in because I knew that Tina Fey and Lorne Michaels were doing it. I was like, I would like to know them. I auditioned for a couple months and then I was basically just like, I want to do this, but you have to know that I am equally as grateful for this opportunity as I want to do music. So if you agree to help me, I'm doing this. Arrivo, So you worked with them for the purposes of getting music done? Rep, I just knew what I wanted. I've always been under the impression that theater is very hierarchical, and it's very like, we sit behind this table, so we tell you if you're going to be good enough for this. I just think that's BS. So I was like, I appreciate this. Holy SH expletive. I cannot believe that I get to do this. And also, help me, too. I'm doing this to do more, not doing this to stay here. Arrivo, I think we sometimes are ashamed or afraid to say, I want to do this and I want to grow beyond this. Because the growth beyond also means that if I come back, I'm going to be different. I'm going to feel different. It has to have elevated. I felt the same. I knew I wanted to do The Color Purple when it came to London. I was doing Sister Act, and we heard that it was coming in, and I was like, oh, I'm supposed to be doing that. I'm going to do that. Someone was like, would you be an understudy? And I was like, I would, but that's not what I want. I want the role. I was meant to play that role. There was nothing anyone could tell me that would stop me. So many people said no. I went in and didn't hear back for 2 months after the audition. Then they were doing it in London at this little theater, 200-seater. I knew I was supposed to do it. I was like, I just love this show. That production is the reason we did it on Broadway. Rep, that's so cool. Arrivo, Ben Brantley of the New York Times did a review of the show in London, and that sent us to Broadway. My entire life changed. Rep, it's just so interesting to hear you talk about it because I feel that way in the back of my head all the time. I know exactly what I want to do, but trusting it is sometimes tough. You know that that's exactly what you wanted to do, and that's exactly the role you were going to play. You're constantly convincing yourself of this thing. You actually believe it, but to everyone else? Arrivo, it looks insane. I know, I sounded absolutely insane. I know I sounded crazy. I just felt so sure about what that was, and I think I've learned now to just listen to that. I've learned at this point, whatever is telling me to do it is telling me now, so I'll follow. My heart, gut, mind, whatever is telling me, so I'm just going to do it. And 9 times out of 10, it's the best decision to make. Some people call it happy accidents, but I don't think they're accidents. Rep, I don't think so either. This is taking me out. I always feel so strange saying this to people because it makes me want to just crawl into a hole. But I've been such a huge fan of yours for a long time. But more important than fan, I've always looked up to you. Arrivo, I would have never known that. I would never have thought that at all. Rep, you're like a vocal Bible to teenagers in theater. I think that's why I'm crying, because you're so integral in something that I didn't know I wanted to do, that I ended up doing, that ended up changing my life. The way you were doing it, and the way you carry yourself, and the way you move is just on a different planet. Arrivo, I'm blown away. The thing that I'm processing here is that the thing you are telling me is the thing I want to do. Now I'm getting emotional. Because it's not just showing up and singing. It's not just being in a room and making sounds. It's also trying to give permission to people to just be themselves. I think I spend my time trying to make sure that people know that that's okay, because there's so many other things telling you to be everything you're not. All I've ever really done is be myself, and it means a lot. Rep, you know how everyone is like, don't meet your heroes. It will change your opinion of them. I definitely have had that, literally, so many times. But you are exactly as I imagined, pictured, seen, and like 10 times more. Arrivo, how are you feeling about your music right now and what you're moving into with new music? Rap, it's kind of the same thing that we're talking about. I feel so sure that I'm obsessed with it. It's everything that I want it to be. I've had my album name for months. I've known exactly what we're moving into. This is the world we're going into. My anxieties prior to that were not getting it, and now the world has actually been achieved and not just an idea. Now I'm so stubborn. I'm like, this is going to be amazing. Arrivo, if your DNA says things is good, then it's probably great. Rap, it's that innate sort of feeling. I've recorded so many songs here at Electric Lady. They've all been asked. 8 hours later, I've put these poor producers and writers through a session, and I'm like, yeah, we're never recouping this one, boys. The day's gone. Writing is just kind of like that, I guess. Do you feel that way? Arrivo? The last year has been insane because I've been doing it at the same time as Wicked. So making a whole album and shooting that movie at the same time. I'm in London talking to my producer, who's in L.A. Then we'd come together in L.A., record everything, do a big old week or 2 week session. Then I go back and finish filming. Then we finally had this concentrated amount of time to move through everything. I'm really specific. There's no partying in my studios. There's no alcohol in my studios. It's just me and a microphone, a writer and a piano. And out of those sessions has come some really beautiful music. And I'm so excited to be able to share it. It's exactly what I dreamt of. On my last album, I just didn't get to do what I needed, and it wasn't what it was supposed to be. I'm still proud of it because we made it in a pandemic. Rap, you probably have more space to be thoughtful and really intentional. I feel like every single project that you do, there's always going to be things on the next one that you're like, I wish this part of me was in the last one, because you didn't have the same thing at that time, especially in the effing pandemic, right? Arrivo, this one fills me with absolute joy because it's all the things I've been through. Pain, joy, the whole thing. I feel deeply connected to what we've managed to write. It feels almost like this is the first album. Rap, this is a dumbass question, but do you feel gassed for the rest of the year? I'm gassed for the rest of your year. I'm effing thrilled. Arrivo, I saw the Wicked film for the first time a couple of months ago. I've been speaking to John Chu, our director, and he is finishing the last shot of the film, putting it all together. I'm just really excited. We've worked through the soundtrack. Me and Ariana Grande have been working hard. We're just excited for it all to come together, for people to see it. I'm very excited. Rap. Do you feel nerves?
Yeah, obviously, because I care.
The day I stop feeling nervous about something I give a SH expletive about, we got a problem.
They're the right kind of nerves. I've learned to decipher. I've definitely not listened to the nerves that go, "You shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be doing this." It bites me on the ass. But the other nerves, that feel like butterflies. Those are the ones I'm getting right now.
Rap, how do you decipher?
Arrivo,
there's a difference. It always feels different. When I get nervousness in my brain, I'm like, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea. But then I get nervousness in my tummy, and it's fine.
Rap, that's a good point. I get a lot of nerves that are in the head. I'm like, you should just push through. You don't know what's best for you.
I always, you don't know what's best for you myself.
Arrivo, we sometimes convince ourselves that we have no idea, but we do.
Rep, bro, I'm the most hard-headed person on the planet.
Arrivo, you're genuinely a Capricorn. And she laughs.
Rap, 100%, but I also think I'm clueless at the same time.
Arrivo,
it means you haven't got to a place of, I know everything.
I don't think we should ever get to that place. You're always learning. All of these experiences are constantly teaching you about yourself, what you can give to your art and what you can't. All of that stuff. So it's fine not to know all of the time. But I'm feeling very excited about the next couple of months.
Rap. Speaking on behalf of everyone, we're all thrilled. We, as a collective, are thrilled. I, specifically, am very thrilled. Very thrilled.
I saw Bo and Yang.
Arrivo.
Oh, I love Bowen.
Rap, he's the greatest. He's perfect. I saw him before the first trailer came out, and he was like, you're going to lose your SH expletive. I was like, really? You think I'm going to lose my SH expletive? He was like, definitely. And I heard the vocal lick at the end, and I was like, yeah, I'm good. I'm going to kill myself. This is amazing.
Arrivo, I love what they've allowed us to do with the music in this piece. It's not that we've rewritten the book or anything, but we've been allowed the space to put ourselves into the music.
Rap, it shows.
Arrivo,
it's been really lovely because it's mammoth. And it has its own history, and people love it, and people know it very well. So there could be the tendency just to do it as it was. But there wasn't any of that. It was like, you know the music. Do what feels the most truthful to you. And that meant that singing this music was really pleasurable. I loved doing this.
Rap, I'm so excited.
Arrivo, it's been fun these last couple months, and I think it's going to be really crazy the next couple, which is great.
Rep, I'm sure. You're going to be tired. Hit your 3 a.m. workout and then go to work?
Arrivo, maybe. How are you taking care of yourself these next couple of months? Because I know that you're trying to come out with new music.
Rap, I mean, I don't know. I want to make sure that I have hit every possible turn. I want to run the creative part of my brain into the ground. I need to be so sure.
Arrivo, I get that.
Rap, do you like to write any specific way? Do you start on piano all the time? Arrivo, we've been doing different things. Sometimes I'll have an idea in my head, and I will sing out a vocal pad and write over that. Rap, oh, sick. Arrivo, or it will be piano or guitar. Sometimes there's a story that I want to tell, so we start with a story. It just depends. I have synesthesia, so I see the color. I'll be like, can you play something more in red? And then I realize it's actually more pink. Can you play it more pink? Rap, do you feel that ever when you're acting, or is it just music? Arrivo, just music. I've learned how to turn the dial down a little bit. But I just did this concert with an orchestra, and they started playing, and all I could see or feel was pink. Really bright pink. It was hitting me in the back of my neck. It was the most visceral physical experience. It's a full body experience, but that feeling is wonderful. Rap, that's so wild, so cool. Next, in Random Notes, My Life and Songs. Chris Martin on the moments that define Coldplay. The frontman looks back on 10 of the band's best songs and talks about how he's learned to let go. By Larisha Paul. Chris Martin remembers what it felt like when the script flipped. It happened just after Coldplay's second album, 2002's A Rush of Blood to the Head. We started to get the backlash to having become popular, and then suddenly we were the least popular band in the world as well, the frontman says over Zoom from Los Angeles. We never had to deal with that before, and we were a total mess. With their 10th album, Moon Music, out now, Martin looks back on the lessons they've learned since then, and tells us why he sees the band's story winding down soon. By the time we finish album 12, which is the end, it will all make sense, he says. So if it doesn't sound like Coldplay right now, don't worry, because it will eventually. We begin with Yellow, 2000. Without this song, there wouldn't be any of the others, like any of our really good songs. I had nothing to do with it. It just happened to arrive to me. We were recording in Wales and the tape machine broke. There was a problem. Something was broken, and it created a space for something cool to arrive. I went outside and I was with our producer at the time, Ken Nelson. He said, look at the stars. It was such a beautiful night. Before I knew it, this whole song just dropped through. Clocks, 2002. I think if I was to try and work out what that piano was inspired by, there's a Bruce Springsteen song where the piano part has a similar kind of arpeggio. But I don't know. The lyrics, even on the record, are not quite finished. It's one of the songs that we still have to play, every show, and it's fun to play. When we played Glastonbury, we played the big stage for the first time that year, and we got this massive green laser. Ever since then, whenever we play Clocks, there has to be a laser. Fix You, 2005. We were having a very, very difficult time as a band. We had just become relatively successful with the first two albums. We were still on the same label, but the ownership that at that time was obsessed with share prices. We just didn't know any better. I just got married. I had a baby, who's now a young woman. I was so out of my depth in every direction, and so were the rest of us. There was addiction. There was just all of the things. I'm happy we went through that period. It led to some really great things afterward. But if it wasn't for Fix You, that would have been the end of the band. Viva La Vida, 2008. We started studying with Brian Eno and a guy called Marcus Droves. We went back to nothing. There was no pressure except to rediscover the joy of being in a band. Brian was 60 at the time. He would come in every day like a child full of curiosity and wonder and excitement. When it was finished, our label asked us to take it off the album because they said it didn't really sound like Coldplay. But what we are, as a band, is a band who are committed to doing what feels right at the time and following the songs. Paradise, 2011. That song came from being a massive Rihanna fan and loving the repeating of Ella, Ella, Ella at the end of Umbrella. And I was thinking, I wonder if you could do that at the beginning of a song and repeat the first syllable, para, para, para. Then The X Factor. That show was ginormous at that time, and like everyone else, I loved watching it. I played the song to the rest of the band. I said, I think we should give this away to the winner of The X Factor. And drummer Will Champion was like, no, we're not giving that up. We'll do that one. Thank you very much. A Sky Full of Stars, 2014. The rest of the band were back in England. I was here in L.A. I called Avicii and said, there's a song called A Sky Full of Stars. Please, will you help produce it? I'd never met him before, and he came in like a thunderbolt. Have you ever seen The Incredibles? You know the kid Dash? Avicii was like Dash. He would do things so quickly that you wouldn't be able to see it. I'd done the piano and the vocals. The next morning, I received a fully formed EDM banger on my phone from him. It was incredible. Adventure of a Lifetime, 2015. I was feeling like, our next single can't be a song where I'm in the front of it. That's tired. I was thinking, God, I wish we could do a song where it was led by the guitar riff. We haven't had one of those for so long. One of my big jobs is to listen to guitarist Johnny Buckland improvise over the loop of a new song, which is a technique Eno taught us. There was a jam called Legends, which was not a very good song, but Johnny was playing on it, and I said, that riff is amazing. Daddy, 2019. I don't know if it's about me apologizing to my kids or talking to my dad. At that time, I was reading about the American justice system. There's a book called The New Jim Crow about the massive over-incarceration of innocent black men. So many dads are taken away from their kids, and they haven't done anything at all. Nothing. That whole album, Everyday Life, is about things like that. Look, these are the things we see happening. We're not living in a utopian vacuum. My Universe with BTS, 2021. I'd got a message that BTS were looking for a song, and I thought, don't be ridiculous. That would never work. But it stuck in my head. The song was about people who are told they can't be together, whether that's Romeo and Juliet, or interracial couples, or interfaith couples, or places where there's no LGBTQ+ permission. It felt like the coolest person to sing that song with would be someone who we're not supposed to be with. It turned out to be the most uplifting, natural collaboration. I would do anything for those guys. Now we're a boy band of 7 really good-looking young Koreans and 1 old white guy. And 10th of the band's best songs, All My Love, 2024. All My Love is really the final Coldplay single. After this, we don't want to do that. I love singing it, I love playing it, and I don't really have anything to say about it other than Coldplay have never been cool. Never will be cool. We might be number 1, or we might be number 100. None of it really matters. These are our songs, and this is what we do. And if you like it, amazing. Here it is for you. Well, that is all the time we have for today. This has been Christine with Rolling Stone. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.